I'll pass it over to John, who will speak.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with old friends like David Bailey, old brothers like my brother, and really old friends like Richard Guy. But joking aside, I just thought I'd show you a picture of Sydney. My daughter texted me yesterday from Newcastle. I'm living about 100 miles north of there, saying the sky is bright orange, and I thought she was exaggerating, but she certainly isn't. It's a dust cloud the size of France. So on that note, let me open my talk. What I've done is design a talk in two pieces. The first is more philosophical, methodological, interspersed with a couple of mathematics examples. And the second part has five examples of mathematics that I've done with people like David Bailey and my brother over the last 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 30 years, where I happen to have benchmarks from various periods. And I went back while I was preparing the talk, and either somebody was nice enough to have done a recent computation on the same problem, or I got it done myself. And I thought it was instructive to watch Moore's Law in action, along with other things of that kind. I probably won't finish that second part of the talk, but it's all already online this address, and it will be, which is my new research center in Newcastle. A little bit of more positive advertisement for New South Wales. That's one of the beaches in Newcastle where routinely the Australian or the World Surfing Championships are held. It's a really lovely part of the world. The quote by Polya: mathematicians seem to break into two groups, those who live forever and those who don't. Polya definitely was in the second group, those who do. He was born the same year as Ramanujan and had the good taste to live for 65 years longer than Ramanujan. I actually had the privilege of hearing him give the invited address to the American Math Society much nearer to the end date than, much nearer than the beginning date. But his influence on all sorts of things, from mathematical pedagogy to artificial intelligence, has been huge. And he's one of the few people who made it into my professional life, I mean, as an active participant while I was already a professional mathematician, who had been polled by Jacques Adamar when he wrote Psychology of Invention in the Mathematical Field. I could tell a whole long, interesting hour of stories, I think, about Polya, but I won't. I did, however, think that these two quotes are well worth starting with. In the first place, the beginner must be convinced that proofs deserve to be studied, that they have a purpose, that they are interesting. He, by a beginner, means a school student, but I take it to be equally compelling as the bit of the quote above for anyone beginning any new research, any new learning. We're all beginners most of the time when we're doing research. I wanted to show you where I now live. This is really aimed at our friends at Fields. Here's Toronto. A nice town that you can visit occasionally but don't have to live in. Here's the Hunter Valley, the oldest wine area in Australia, and that star is Newcastle on the coast. Sydney and that horrid dust cloud. Well, the dust cloud's over everything. The abstract I won't go through in detail, more or less to say that I think that there are real challenges to the notion of proof at the moment. Most of us who use Maple today or Mathematica today probably have some idea of what it does, or at least those of us who used it 10 years ago. That's going to be less and less the case over the next generation. So we're really looking at moving from the automobile as something you didn't drive unless you could fix, to the automobile as something that you hope your GPS system will call when something's wrong. That's a very different mindset and a very different set of tools, and I think we have to address those. Now you can say, well, gee whiz, what's it going to mean when people say, and I heard a wonderful talk recently characterizing the 50 false projective planes, very deep mathematics coming out of the work of Mumford and many others, hugely computational at various levels. And when I asked the speaker, we had two sets of lectures on this, I asked the speaker, can you certify any digits of those integrals? And his jaw dropped. I'd never thought about it. So in other words, one key component of this deep modern work, which was based on papers, Invenciones, and you name it, was that they just didn't even realize that switching on Mathematica, or for that matter, a month of Fortran integral computations, didn't certify anything. We'll have to come to the understanding that that's changing a lot for a lot of users. But I think that, you know, lest we forget, if anyone wants to stand up and say, I can certify one of these three great breakthroughs, the Poincaré conjecture's probable resolution, Fermat's theorem's almost certain resolution, the classification of finite simple groups, it's clear they're finite and simple, it's not clear they've been classified. It's probably clear they've been classified, but it's not clear, it's clear that not all the details are clear. And over the last 30 years, it's changed several times as to what the prime players think is the state of play. So it's not that we need the computer to be a little less certain about what we're certain about in mathematics. And that's part of the point I want to make. A brief flag for our new research center in Newcastle. CARMA stands for Computer Assisted Research Mathematics and its applications, but it allows me to make a bad pun every time it says, what brought you to Australia? And I say it was CARMA. So what am I actually going to do in the rest of this hour? I'm going to make sure to talk about topic one, working definitions of discovery, of proof, for that matter of mathematics, digital assistance, which is in a sense the key thing I want to talk about, and experimentation, the changing nature of experimentation in general in the sciences. I have five core examples, partition function, pi, Euler's function, zeta 3, and an interesting recent set of results about reciprocal series for 1 upon pi. I probably will not get as far as all of those examples, and I almost certainly won't make my tacit conclusions explicit. They'll be tacit, and if you want to see them made more explicit, they're on the general talk here. I want to highlight, because it's been such great fun, a book that Keith Devlin and I, some of you will know Keith as a professional mathematician, some of him as the math guy on National Public Radio, but Keith and I wrote this book last year called The Computer as Crucible, and a variety of the chapters relate to what we're looking at. The computer knows more math than you do, and danger always exercise caution when using the computer. But I'm most proud of the fact that Karl-Heinz Hoffmann, who's a wonderful illustrator as well as a fine mathematician, produced 20 cartoons, including the cover and the back cover. On the cover, you see two earnest mathematical artisans pouring numbers into a crucible. And on the back cover, you see them pouring the mathematical gold out. So that's the analogy we have for the computer as crucible. The ability to take pieces of mathematics in kind of inchoate form, and as you learn how to do it better, to have real mathematics pour out at the end of the crucible. Okay, part one, philosophy, psychology, etc. I'm not going to read this whole quote. It's one of these great quotes that I would never dare attribute to myself, but I'm happy to have Steve Jones say it. For most wearers of white coats, e.g. real scientists, philosophy is to science as pornography is to sex. It's cheaper, easier, and some people bafflingly seem to prefer it. Outside of psychology, which he makes an exemption, which he has to since he's reviewing Steve Pinker's How the Mind Works, it plays almost no part in the functions of the research machine. We'll come back to this briefly later vis-a-vis the more fundamental role that I do believe philosophy plays in the nature of mathematical research. Although the reality is most of us most of the time just do what we can and don't spend much time thinking about what it means. And nor should we. But I do think, particularly in this present period of flux, it's worth at least thinking a little. So let's start with what a discovery is. Well, there's an interesting recent book by Marcus Giaquinto called Visual Thinking in Mathematics. I should have been warned off by the next sentence, an epistemological study, because when I bought the book, I was hoping it was more cognitive and cerebral and less epistemological. Nonetheless, he says discovering a truth has three components. In short, discovering a truth is coming to believe it in an independent, reliable, and rational way. And if you go back, you find this sort of weasel words. There's a requirement that one's coming to believe it involves no violation of one's epistemic state. Seems to me I can have a pretty weird epistemic state, but I'm sure he means one in some broad, stable sense. Having said that, that's not a bad notion of what a discovery is. It has a wonderfully liberating effect for teaching or for your grad students. Independent, not original. which, you know, when I was writing my thesis, there was a sort of implicit notion that nobody in the world ever, anywhere, had ever published anything that was remotely like your thesis. Well, that's completely off base now. It just doesn't make sense in the modern world. Requiring that the thesis be independent does. So independent, reliable, and rational. So let's... and I wanted to point out this quote. David Bailey and I are embarrassed, but because we're among friends, we will tell you that David found it in Baby Einstein. Tools for bright infants, this quote of Galileo's. But it's a fine quote. It's one of the big threads you see when you go to many of the primary thinkers. They emphasize the primacy, the importance of knowing. Now, we saw a lot of talks yesterday afternoon that in some sense were representative of another big wellspring of mathematics, places where at some level you know, or the community knows in general terms, what the result is. They just don't know how to get there. But this is still a very large part of a lot of creative mathematics, is the sense of knowing the truth. And Galileo was not and is not alone in this view. I'll send you the proof of these theorems in this book. I know you're diligent, an excellent teacher of philosophy, and greatly interested, etc., etc. I am convinced that this is no less useful for finding proofs of these same theorems. For some things which first became clear to me by the mechanical method were afterwards proved geometrically. For it is easier to supply the proof when we have previously acquired by the method some knowledge of the questions. And that's Archimedes in this wonderful, recently reconstructed using more Penrose inverses and medical imaging techniques, his book on the method, and along with it some other things that were thought to have been lost for eons, which were found floating in a bucket and had to be reconstructed in the most appalling way. But it's fabulous. But that's Archimedes' Eratosthenes, the introduction to the method of mechanical theorem. So the same thread. Okay, so let's actually look at the discovery. And I will claim that this is independent, reliable, and rational. I've been looking with my students and others at the expected distance that is moved in a uniform random walk in the plane after one, two, three steps. So the integral that you write down is this, and David and I at the moment with Richard Crandall and a number of others have a passion for trying to work out ways to compute high-dimensional integrals, and high in some cases can mean three, to reasonable precision, enough precision to actually, with some reliability, recover information about the structure of the numbers from the numerical output. So I can tell you that it's a huge challenge to reliably compute 10 digits of W4 or 5 for s equals 1. Here's the quite painfully, we worked out enough theory for me to show you the analytic continuation of W3. And it's the expected distance you move after n steps. Well, W1 is 1, because if you take a random unit step in the plane, after one step, you're one step away from where you went. After two steps, it turns out quite beautifully that the expected distance you've traveled is 4 upon pi. And that's a nice exercise either in probability or in special function evaluation. But remarkably enough, with a question mark, that is the expected distance you have traveled after three steps, where gamma is the gamma function of the third. An object about which I think we may know it's irrational, but maybe not even that, I'd have to check. But it's rather beautifully symmetric, and it's certainly not something that I would have expected 10 years ago to be able to find by computer. Okay. This has been checked to 170 places using 256 of Dave Bailey's cores in about 15 minutes. So even just checking it took learning something really clever about how to compute it. And secondly, that's the sort of amount of time that we used to think nobody would ever have to give to a computation. And this is just one numerical integral, small integral. And the reason that it's true is that we worked out that if you look at the even integer moments, so you put 2k here, that's the 2kth moment. So the first moment is the expectation. W2k is actually a hypergeometric function. And Dirk Nuyens, who's working with us, thought, well, if this is true for integer, even integer k, why don't I just plot it for general real numbers, k? And to his amazement, it was completely wrong, except at the odd integers, where the real part of this function is the correct answer. So here we have two entirely different analytic functions who are twisting around in this amazing way, and this is not something one would ever expect, certainly I wouldn't. And therefore, except for the fact that it was displayed to us, you know, that literally you don't have to be a mind reader to say, hey, wait a minute, the real part of that thing is this thing. It's a discovery. It's independent, reliable, and rational. It ain't a proof. It's certainly right. We think we may be able to prove it now. And interestingly enough, this relates completely to work, recent work of Bruce Richmond's and Jeff Shalit's on counting abelian squares. This is the number of abelian squares on K letters, which I won't bother defining. But just to say, suddenly you're getting combinatorics out of probability via analysis. It's really nice. Okay. So what's mathematics? Well, I took a definition of mathematics. It's somewhat self-referent since I co-authored it, but I think we actually inherited this in the Collins Dictionary, wrote from a definition in the earlier, bigger Collins, general Collins Dictionary. A group of related subjects, da-da-da-da-da, number, quantity, shape, generalizations, abstractions, nowhere do you see, nor should you see, the word proof or the methods of study that are allowed. Second point of evidence. And I remind you of the distinction between induction and deduction, necessarily supported by the premises, and supported by the premises, but not necessarily. Marvelous lecture that Kurt Gödel gave, and David and I had seen this quote. It only was ever published in his posthumous notebooks, but it was actually part of Gödel's Gibbs lecture in 1951. I thoroughly recommend a recent book, just come out in the last year or so, called A World Without Time, which is a brief 200-page description of Gödel's friendship with Einstein and of Gödel's work to produce space-times in which there were loops. I'm not sure I'm persuaded by his ontological argument that time can't exist because of that, but I am. It's a marvelous recapitulation of the history of modern philosophy of science, the Vienna Circle, you name it. Just a marvelous little book, A World Without Time. What's a proof? Well, again, from my own dictionary, it's what you think it is. But again, this is very much a 20th century idea of formalizing the notion of a proof, distinguishing proof from truth. So this is, in some sense, all after Gödel. That in some sense, the formalist program couldn't succeed because nobody had set up to distinguish the notion of truth and proof. And nor had it ever seemed necessary. So to go back to the notion of induction, thus an inductive argument may be highly probable that lead to a false conclusion. For example, that all swans are white. They're the swans in my local park. Gorgeous animals, definitely not white. But remember when the notion of a black swan was used, it was used in a society for which they had never been seen, never existed. It was used essentially as almost a necessary characteristic of a swan that it be white. So whenever we're doing things that are inductive, the reason that Popper, for example, didn't believe that inductive reasoning could ever lead to truth in the sciences and therefore gave us the now dominant view that in the sciences all we do is falsify, is because of this problem that at some level you can argue that no amount of inductive evidence, he argued, can be compelling. I don't believe that's true. I don't, and I think a lot of thinkers don't think it's true. But there's always doubt. But so is there doubt in the classification of finite simple groups, or at least in the details of the argument. So what do I mean by digital assistants? I mean the use of modern mathematical packages. They can be symbolic, numeric, geographic, graphical. More and more they're all. So they're hybrid in some sense. And often the use of more specialist packages, and we've heard Paris, C++, Magma, at least all mentioned already in the last couple of days. I mean the use of web applications, whether it's Sloan's Encyclopedia of Integer Sequences or Peter and my inverse symbolic calculator, a variety of other things like that, they're just as much part of how we, in 2009, do digitally assisted mathematics. And the use of web databases, in which I include Amazon, JSTOR. I put two questions about Wolfram Alpha, not because I doubt its existence. They all entail data mining in the terms that I'm going to describe in a little more detail on the next slide. Exploratory experimentation in the presence of widening technologies for which you can view Maple or Mathematica or MATLAB as a widening technology. A technology that allows you to look in directions that you were unable to look by yourself or with a speed or rapidity or accuracy that you couldn't use before. And whether you think of McTutor as an exemplary way to get really reliable evidence, Joe, for your class in Kelowna, or whether you read one of the math historians saying that it's the greatest Satan to blight mathematical history since Josephus, I don't know what the analogy is, both are true, but they're context dependent. It would be a silly thing to write a thesis in mathematical history based entirely on McTutor, but it's a fine, fine tool for most informal needs. A wonderful tool in its context. I also don't entirely believe this quote of Danny Hillis's, knowing things is very 20th century, you just need to be able to find things. But it is clear that the balance between knowing and finding is changing. When I started teaching in the 70s, I used to put 2 points on a calculus assignment for telling me the value of E to 6 places. It's not such a good question even after the TA calculator became popular. So what I mean by exploratory experimentation is a young scientist, Franklin, a young philosopher of science, she argues that a notion that's been articulated by other philosophers, Mankell, Steinel, of exploratory experimentation, where you have an experiment that is really just hunting over big data sets or large amounts of natural data and trying to uncover patterns without any pre-existing even local model. It's too much to expect that when you start in any part of science and mathematics that you have a fully fleshed out explicative model because you don't know what you're looking at. But it's become canonical in the last 100 years that we have to have a model, a hypothesis, something to falsify, something to confront. And they make the case that if you look in places like pharmacology, well, where you can, say, build a biochip and look at a million different possible chemicals, chemical combinations, biochemical combinations, rule things out very quickly, and not only go in the notion of, well, I know that that enzyme activates that pathway, and therefore I will look at 3 of these other things. That's what it would be called exploratory experimentation, and the widening technologies can be the biochips, the DNA matching algorithms, or MATLAB. Henrik Sorensen, who's a very thoughtful young philosopher of mathematics in Aarhus, writes, the importance of widening instrumentation from an exploratory approach to experiments that includes concept formation is also pertinent to mathematics. So I think it's fair to say that the boundaries between mathematics and natural sciences, I mean, which is more experimental, string theory or the work that Michael Monaghan was doing yesterday on the size of coefficients of the cyclotomic polynomials? Well, clearly, what Michael was doing. So the boundaries between the hard sciences and mathematics, between inductive and deductive reasoning, I think are continuing to blur. And as Frank Quinn and Arthur Yaffe wrote about 15 years ago in the notices, they called what we would call informal reasoning formal reasoning. But they said, at least be honest about which it is you think you've done. Have you got good reasons for believing something, or are you claiming this is a proof? Okay. So again, I've at least implicitly talked a couple of times about changing user expectations or settings, and this is a really compelling example, at least for me. Who here has heard of the Stroop test? Good. At least I can say never have I been in an audience where nobody says yes. I got a strong group of computational psychologists in my university. When I mentioned this to them, what I'm going to tell you, their ears went up like antennas. This is something they teach every single student in every single cognition course. Okay, so the first thing I want you to do is to look at the tableau on the left and say the color represented by the word. So you're supposed to say white. Say the color represented by the font color, you're supposed to say green. Now, almost all people our age, and this has been true over 70 years, find the second harder than the first. try doing this and getting it right for yourself. And this has been a very, very replicable, measurable phenomenon. But it's changing. My youngest daughter, who's 18, who's really the first born digital of my kids, somehow intrinsically, implicitly, has grown up understanding the difference between syntax and semantics in a different way. We've got to keep that in account, too. If we find certain affordances easier, what gets called in a lot of psychologically based cognition, embodied cognition, acknowledges that we're creatures, human, we're humans, we're mammals. We have optical systems. We find certain things easier to pick up than others. We ought to be actually designing our tools and the ways in which we teach things to take account of what we're actually learning about what we find easy and what we find hard. And the fact that I'm moving my arms like this, the whole bulk of evidence that says, you're picking up a great deal of my talk from that without knowing it. So this is, I think, a cool example of how things are changing. So this is usually viewed as an example of interference. When you're asked the second question, what you're seeing is interfering with what you're expected to do. And I guess in the land of Twitter, we're going to be living with nothing but interference. Other cognitive shifts. Well, at the other end of the scale, this is an article very recently in Science on what's called strategic reasoning, strategic reading. When an ontology gets small, it's called a micro-ontology. When it gets even smaller, it's called a non-ontology. But joking aside, accelerated and enhanced by reading tools that take advantage of ontologies, reading practices will become even more rapid and indirect, transforming the ways in which science engage literature and shaping the evolution of scientific publishing. It's an interesting article, and they make the real observation that when we browse tables of contents or abstracts, or just literally titles of articles online, we are putting together for ourselves an ontology. We're saying, oh, she's published yet another long and boring article on the same as the last five. Oh, look, there's my really interesting stuff. We're doing that sort of stuff. But the fact is, we're not just saying no, 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 no. We're also sensing what's occurring in that journal, what are we gaining, where do these things fit in? And clearly, those are things that can be enhanced by all sorts of intelligent agents and tools. But I think they also are potentially very hostile to mathematical research patterns. I think Ram said yesterday, and other people have said, we mainly don't read. Well, it's true. But when we do read, we tend to burrow into one theorem or one piece of an argument, and the sort of flowing strategically through mathematics is not entirely, I think, the way that it works well. But these are clearly big shifts going on in what's possible. Okay, so very briefly, by experimental mathematics, I mean the eight things we wrote down, or something like them, and David and I wrote these down in our first book on experimental math. There's nothing God-given about them, but I did break them down into the first five, which I think are, in a sense, truly experimental, and the last three, which are very important, but are not in the same category from the point of concept formation or experiment. And for me, this one, number five, was really where I first started to seriously use a computer to do mathematics. In much of what we do as research, you don't know until you've gone a long way down the road if it's going to pan out. And if your only way of keeping yourself on track is to prove every lemma, you become conservative, and it's slow. If you have contingent ways to say, well, wait a minute, I'm still at least looking at the same object. Look, my prediction would be that I get eight Galois groups with this property, and I get eight, I'm happy that I'm still doing the right thing. I can go back later if it's gone to a point on the road I want. That, I think, is a hugely important component. And another minor comment, and this is almost too trivial to need to say in this context, when I was asked to compare the red curve to the black curve as a student, I didn't have any pictures. I only had calculus. Now I have pictures. These cross, don't try to prove one's bigger than the other. These don't cross. If there's a problem with the red one being lower than the black one, it only happens at one. Even in very primitive software, you'll be able to zoom and try a few more times. You'll know what the situation is very quickly. And then if you care, you can try to prove it. Okay. So let's take a sort of Full Metal Jacket example. About 15 years ago, Andrew Granville emailed me the number alpha and challenged me to identify it. It was just after we'd first put, with Simon Plouffe, our inverse calculator online. Well, one of the things that I now articulate more than I did then is one of the great powers of computation within number theory or mathematics is to change representations. And so I asked for its continued fraction. Well, one thing we can all agree is that's a pattern. And we don't need Sloan's encyclopedia to tell us that it's the positive integers. So we are, in some sense, no further in, quote, identifying the number, although maybe that's a good answer. That's the decimal that corresponds to the integers of continued fraction. I reached for a good book on continued fractions, and I found the answer. It's the ratio of two Bessel functions of the first kind. Actually, I knew that all arithmetic continued fractions arose in such fashion, but that's absolutely irrelevant to how you can now proceed. In this year, there are at least three other strategies. Okay? Once you've found one, type arithmetic progression and continued fraction into Google, or something thereof. Type the first seven or so entry terms into Sloan's encyclopedia. I didn't think of doing that myself until a couple of years ago. I was giving a summer course to MAA, and I gave things like this for the afternoon's explorations, and three of the students in the lab said, oh, I found the answer, it's on Sloan. Okay. You can say, well, that's cheating. They're not really integer sequences, but if they're in there, they are. Okay. So let me illustrate those. Late last year, I typed exactly those two expressions in, and all I've done to the web page that came back is to pretty it. First thing, continued fraction from math world. Continued fractions, even more general than the arithmetic progression. And a reference to Perron, which is the book I had in mind. The second one is one of the original hack memos. These are from the days when a hacker was an MIT grad student and somebody was proud to be a hacker. And you see, in fact, specifically the value of this continued fraction, the general arithmetic progression. And the third is a paper by Bunshu from about 10 years ago. And if you look under the math world entry, it actually includes Schrippel's hack mem formula for the closed form for the continued fraction a plus d, a plus 2d, a plus 3d. This is all without being able to really search online for mathematics. If and when we can, and for example, JSTOR keeps its records in LaTeX. If you know that, you can actually search on a lot more in a JSTOR paper than you might have imagined, because you can do some heuristics for yourself. But in any event, this was really a matter of seconds, and it doesn't take any real knowledge. And there's even enough here, if we go on, to whether or not you know what the Bessel function is, to be told very, very quickly. So if we do this in the integer sequence database, and this, who's used the integer sequence database? This always gets a better return now. He's done great. I gather it's being made into a wiki, which may or may not be a good thing. But he's been running it at AT&T now for 40 years, successfully behind an AT&T firewall without getting in your way. So if we enter those terms, as I said, well, you can see what comes back. The value of this continued fraction is the ratio of these two Bessel functions, and here's the actual definition of the Bessel functions in a friendly special function way, just as a kind of double exponential like series, double factorial series. And what's terrific about his database is that it comes with proper links. If we go down, we would find real references. There's often pseudocode or real code in one of half a dozen formats, at least one of which you can probably implement and most of which you can read. But notice this would only have worked after May 14th, 2001, because that's the date at which Robert Wilson decided to add the sequence to the database. Again, just in terms of good use of digital resources, the reason why you should say when you went to that database, which version you used. The inverse calculator will, since 1995 online, have returned this best guess and exactly that Bessel function. So I'm going to illustrate the inverse calculator on another example. This is its 2.0 version. which has less lookup tables and more computing because things are quicker than they were 15 years ago. And if we try, that, by the way, is a very bad approximation to pi. It's root 2 plus root 3. But if we want to know what that number 12.58 is, we just hit inverse calculate, and up comes e plus pi squared. And David will talk more about this kind of methodology in the second talk, but we have, if suppose that I know the number to 30 places, and I find it to 10 places, we have really never seen, except in a contrived way, a place where that extra 20 orders of magnitude conformation holds, and it's not an identity. So it's a very powerful way, it suffers of finding information structure where you wouldn't know it was. This number, for example, turns out to be the first 10 digits of e to the pi minus pi, for which there's no real explanation. Not all coincidences have an explanation. And it was really, really impressive before high-precision calculators, because you couldn't get beyond the 999-0999. One other comment about changing ways of viewing different kinds of mathematics. This is an implementation in Cinderella, and this one at the bottom right in Maple, of looking at 10,000 iterations of a dynamical algorithm that is actually quite important in folding, protein folding, but is also being used to produce huge Sudoku puzzles and to do quite well on tree satisfiability. In other words, on hard, on NP-hard and NP-complete problems. And we are starting to work out the theory about why it works for non-convex sets. So what we're doing is finding the point of intersection of a line, convex, and a circle, non-convex. And it's whizzing in, and we're actually watching, colored by the distance from the right, left-hand, sorry, the vertical axis, where the points go, 10,000 points at a time. So I was just delighted when I realized I could visualize these in Cinderella, but when I did this, we got all these strange, clearly, provably wrong things. All those red things flowing around. Even though Cinderella, and this is just in the plane with very simple ideas of reflect, reflect, and average, 14 digits computation was not enough numerical stability. When we worked out how to do the computation in Maple and export it to Cinderella, you notice that all these extra points have gone away and all the things that's supposed to be on the line are on the line. It's quite an eye-opener to me to see in a two-dimensional piece of mathematics that only needed really the ideas of high school arithmetic and geometry, that stability, numerical stability of this kind, was really an issue to see what was going on. So that's quite cool too. And looking for more ways to see a gestalt of what's happening. We can now prove, by the way, that that iteration spins in the way it looks like it does. Okay. Well, I say this picture is worth 1,000 UNIACs because the next thing I want to do briefly is talk about Moore's Law. I paid $100 for this picture from the Smithsonian. They sent me a 20 meg TIFF file, or rather they gave me permission to take it for 48 hours. I realized a little later it would have taken about 100,000 ENIACs to store its own picture, and that I had six of them lost on my desktop. And it was easier to let a million ENIACs slosh around on my computer than to find them. That, for me, is the most compelling example of Moore's Law that I know, just in terms of gauging how much we have to gain from six or seven orders of magnitude improvement in what we can do over the last generation. There, by the way, is a picture of the two men who built the ENIAC. Marvelous recent book called ENIAC that I strongly recommend to you. Really interesting social and computational and IP history. But Adam, David may well say something more about this sort of slide, I don't know, in the next hour. But I wanted to highlight one thing. Twice a year, the top 500 list shows these sort of charts. And I'm just going to point to one thing with that red line. The line to the top is the aggregate of power in the whole top 500. The middle line is the most powerful machine. The bottom line is the worst machine on the top 500 list. So we put a machine at number 300 and something a few years ago. But notice that the worst machine now has more power than the best machine about a decade ago. And than the best machine about 6 years ago. And then the whole top 500 a decade ago. It will be strange if we can't find ways to harness that extraordinary improvement in power to mathematical research. And I mean for concept formation, not just for kind of nailing down hard, long calculations. Okay, so in my remaining 10-15 minutes, I want to flash through some other examples. I want to juxtapose it by saying that whereas Steve Jones is pretty and appropriately cynical about the role of philosophy, as is Steve Weintraub, the Nobel physicist, he, in a very erudite way, takes apart philosopher's attempt.
Steve Weinberg.
That's okay. Hermann Weyl, and most mathematicians writing about these things take the philosophy more seriously. That's really my only point here. Okay, so let's look at a first example. My question with a lot of these things was, what's changed in what we can do over the last 2-3 decades? So let me remind you, probably not necessarily for many people in the room, the number of additive partitions of a number, in many ways much harder to study than prime decompositions because there is no prime decomposition. I have not as much structure, but there is a beautiful generating function that goes back to Euler, which is this. And you can see that just by expanding each of these terms by the geometric formula and asking how does a power of q to the n occur, and it will have a number of 1s plus a number of 2s, and the way n occurs will definitely be exactly p of n. So this is what. So I went to give a talk to an audience in about 1991 that included George Andrews, and I had a brand new first-of-generation Mac portable. So I thought, how could I compute P of 200, a very famous computation of P of 200 by McMahon at the beginning of the last century. How could I, if I were just completely naively to use this formula. Now, you can use this formula quite cleverly to build interesting recurrences. But I just said, what happens if I take the 200th term of the Taylor series? Well, in 1991, it took 20 minutes. This year, it took 0.17 seconds on a sort of comparable, not racing fast machine of the time, just laptop I happen to have. By the same token, in 2 minutes, I could now produce this number. And I emphasize entirely naively. Now, one of the things that changed is in 1991, Maple and Mathematica actually did this by taking the series, they wrote this as 1/a series, but they didn't take the series of the bottom, they took the series of the reciprocal. And that ended up being a much harder calculation than if you took the series of the bottom and then took the series of the series for the bottom. Now the computer algebra systems are clever enough, and you won't see this, that they've actually changed an n cubed algorithm to an n squared algorithm without telling you. So when you say, oh, it took me this or that, it's always a very fraught kind of announcement, because you've really no idea, unless you did it yourself, what God did. Nonetheless, from a practical point of view, this is stunning, that without thinking, I can just type this in and get this answer. In the same way, Richard Crandall has now tuned the Hardy-Ramanujan-Rathenacker series to be able to compute P of 10 to the ninth in 3 seconds. Just stunning. And to compute these two probable primes, 35,000-digit probable primes. So the question I wanted to ask here, because I think it's a real one, is when does easy computation actually get in the way of intellectual advance? We tend to measure our questions in any period by what people find hard. And we won't probably qualify it by saying, if you don't have a computer, which is a lot of the things you see in a monthly, the big fun in a Putnam problem now. You often see problems that are silly, because they're premised on having no access to computation. And that's fine when you're locked in a room for 6 hours, but it's not the way you're going to think about it. So the canonical Putnam problem, which takes the year and says how many ways are there to do something that add up to 2010, is usually a crummy problem, unless you found something where exhaustive enumeration or the first thing you think of won't do it computationally. A little bit like the reason that we don't spend a lot of time on ruler and compass constructions. It's a question for another period. Anyhow, you can imagine if your budget goes down, you're going to use single digits, you're not going to actually do these things. Certainly not going to try that. Here's a second example. Again, it's more benchmarking. Here's an algorithm for pi that Peter and I discovered in the mid-80s, and These equations, exactly these equations, are specifying at the bottom right an algebraic number which agrees with pi to more than 1.7 trillion places. And every time I see these 20 relatively lean equations, which is just 20 instantiations of this algorithm, and the only thing that is non-stationary is that the power of 2 changes. Quite extraordinary that there is such a thing. An algebraic number floating out there that we can write down, and it only varies from pi after 1.7 trillion places. Well, as a measure, an amazing one, I think, of how Moore's law marches on, Dave Bailey, when we first started to interact, it was because of these things, he computed 29 million digits of pi on the then new Cray 2. Uncovered all sorts of hardware and software errors and led to the algorithms being run at Cray over the next period because they did better at finding errors than the standard reliability tests. Well, this year, the same algorithm has been run on 2 to the 10th cores of an Apo Extreme in Japan to compute 1.65 trillion digits in 64 hours. Well, actually, with our algorithm in 73 hours, but less memory, and with Richard Brent's algorithm in 64 hours, but with more memory. Now, you might say, who cares about a terabyte or so of memory? You know, what's the big deal? But it is interesting to see these precise things. But we're looking at 6 orders of magnitude difference in 25 years. And I'm sure David will make some comments of that kind, but that was kind of cool. And another really lovely quote about the importance or the value of knowing the answer. This is when Carlson, who's already one of the winners of the Abel Prize, spoke at the International Math Congress in 1966 on his then brand new proof that Fourier series converged almost everywhere in L2. Long, interesting article in which he says at one point, for 15 years I was misled and I thought there was a counterexample. When I finally realized there couldn't be one, it really was pretty straightforward to take the theory that existed and show why there was a theorem. Okay. Third of my examples, Eric Wong, who's now doing a PhD, I think, at UBC, among other things, for his sins, and I, in the mid-90s, with Peter and others, we looked at some famous number theory conjectures, some of which we definitely learned from Richard Guy's wonderful book on unsolved problems. And the one that I've had most to do with directly is called Guga's conjecture, which is if you sum over the Fermat's little theorem result for all k, if n is a prime, this is definitely true. And Guga conjectured in the middle of the last century that it's only true for primes. Now, counterexamples are known to be Carmichael numbers. They're pretty rare themselves. They're only proved to be infinite in 1994. So there are not going to be many counterexamples, and it has to be a square-free number, and the reciprocal primes have to add up to more than one, and they have another killer property. They're what Eric and I called a normal sequence, that is, no two primes can be congruent to one mod the other. So if your sequence of primes includes 3, it can't include 7 or 13. If it includes 5, it can't include 11 or 31 or 41, etc. So if it included 3 and 5, it has to go way out and be very sparse, for example. And if it does include 3 and 5, then it's already harder to do this. So we found a rather good... We know what the worst case you can get for any given capital N is, but we can't prove it. But we can use the fact that we know the worst case to see if we find counterexamples. So we were able to massively improve a search algorithm. And so we were able to show in several months that any counterexample had at least 3,459 primes and therefore was at least nearly 14,000 digits long. But look, it was 5 days to do that. The method we're using will actually fail after 8,135 primes because a function sort of like the LI example you showed yesterday, something that looks like it's always true is provably going to stop being true. Not in such a hyperbolic way, but nonetheless, I kind of like the idea of actually having used up an algorithm, a non-trivial algorithm. So we keep going back to it. So I did that while preparing this talk. I obtained this bound in under 2 hours on my notebook just while I was preparing the talk. And I obtained this bound in 14 hours. Now, we were using C++ before, which was a huge mistake because it took 6 weeks to program instead of 1 day. And then when we took it to the supercomputer in Japan, it crashed on the first new case and nobody spoke enough English to help us. So there are always other reasons apart from speed of compilation to decide whether you, which language you want to use. But on one core of my Mac Pro, we've now obtained this exclusion bound in 13 hours in Maple. And so we're actually now doing the sensible thing and we've parallelized it just to see how far we can go. But again, we're going from 6 months in the mid-90s with a lot of pain to a day, half a day now. And so I quite like the fact that we kept the programs around so we could actually get some sense of where the bottlenecks were. And I don't know, for example, whether Michael yesterday had parallelized his cyclotomic work, but I would imagine that that's absolutely critical if you're going to go much further. So there's a lovely conjecture of Lehmer's that phi of n only divides n minus 1 when n is prime. And he calls it in his 1932 paper as hard as the existence of odd perfect numbers. Because there's no structure that we know of to work with. Now, again, the counterexamples are you'll have to have a square-free odd number and the primes will form another normal sequence. But they won't have these lurid things like having the reciprocals add up to more than one or anything like that. So there's almost no more structure. So the same level of effort, actually more effort, allows you to show only that there will be at least 14 primes, not 3,500 primes in a counterexample. It's just not enough structure there, and curse of exponentiality really comes into play really quickly. So there's an interesting sidebar here. In that lovely article that Lehmer wrote in 1932, he also looks at phi of n dividing n plus 1. And then it turns out that there are 8 solutions with 7 factors. 6 factors was actually solved by Lehmer. 7 was due to Eric Wong and his thesis. So we can only get up to 7 in this case, and I don't think we could do 8 today because it's just such a huge search base. We don't know anything else. The really remarkable thing is the solutions are 2, 3, 3 times 5, 3 times 5 times 17, dot, dot, dot. That's the product of the Fermat primes. If there was another Fermat prime, there would be another counterexample or another example. And a rogue pair, these two, that he found. Now, Lehmer couldn't factor this number. You say, what is that number? Well, it's 2 bigger than this number. It turns out, in general, that if you have a counterexample and n plus 2 is prime, you have another counterexample. So Lehmer says, I don't know how to factor this number, which is really that he didn't have the ease to do stupid things, because he sure knew how to find small factors of numbers. And it turns out the number he couldn't factor in 1932 is divisible by 73. So what he said here hasn't changed, but this went from being something he thought fit to write at the end of the paper to a triviality. So we need always to go back and see when things have changed. It would be great if it was prime, but hey. My final example. The following 3 formulas have been known for many decades, and I'm deliberately obscure because it's part of the story I'll finish by telling. This is actually comes from the arcsine, the Taylor series for arcsine squared. This one, Ram Murthy described very nicely yesterday as the basis for Apéry's proof that zeta 3 is irrational. And it's often called Apéry's constant now, and it's often called Apéry's formula. This one seems first to have been written down by Comte in his book on combinatorial identities. The results have led many to speculate. If you look at this, you see central binomial coefficient, small rational number, and in this case, alternating sign. So I think almost any combinatorially, analytically based mathematician is going to look and say, gee, zeta 5. 5 is to 2 as 36 is to 17. What about 202 over whatever? Well, whatever it is, when you actually sit down and look at this ratio and say, what can we tell you if this ratio is just algebraic? Well, the answer is it must have at least one coefficient exceeding 380 or the degree of the polynomial must be more than 25. So the one thing you're not missing is the possibility that there's a really similar result. That's where the kind of tools that David will talk about in a few minutes come into play. But perhaps more interestingly, two more things I want to tell you about Zeta 5. The work that Dave Broadhurst and Joel Kammerter, who was a summer student here about 8-9 years ago, did, shows that in fact you can write this precisely as Zeta 5 and then these polylogarithms. So I don't think we can prove these are algebraically independent, but they certainly are. So this in some sense is the closest you can get to writing Zeta 5 in the right form. And a final kind of just intriguing formula, Ram talked about these wonderful series, Eisenstein-like series that go back to Ramanujan. It turns out that for Zeta 4n plus 1, there's a simpler formula than the one he used. And which, for example, rather, because he used one for Zeta 2n plus 1, and it turns out that if you break it down mod 4, you can be more refined. And here, for example, is the simplest formula you can provide of that kind for Zeta 5. This is what it would be if Euler's formula worked. This is a correction term. And here, this is actually right to error 0.003, and then these two massively rapidly convergent hyperbolic series. So the one comment I wanted to make here as I finish is, since this has less free parameters, maybe there's more chance of using this sort of series to prove some irrationality estimates for Zeta 4n plus 1. And my final slide, or final two slides, nothing is ever new under the sun. I think we've heard this various times. Margot Kondratieva, who's now at Newfoundland, found in Markov's 1890 notebooks this formula, which is a parametric form that if you put in A equals 0 is precisely Apérie's formula. And when you type this into Maple, at least Maple, I think it was 11 when I last did this, it will return this identity, which is actually saying this is true as soon as the Zeta 3 formula is. You can prove it directly, but I want to point out what a computer system can tell you. You can say, yes, I can reduce this to the other one. So it's always dangerous to name something after somebody because the name will almost always be wrong. My final slide and a half. Here are two identities that we pulled off David Bailey and David Bradley and myself, this one in 1995 and this one in 2005. And this is a generating function for 4k plus 3 zeta values, of which the first term is Apérie's formula. And this is a similar thing for even zeta values, for which the first term is the arcsine squared formula. What do I want to tell you about this? They were both discovered by computer. This one in the mid-90s, when we were sort of first learning how much we could do in a rigorous way, in a designed way, and this one by a much more designed experiment. Louis Ganin showed this to Paul Erdős a few months before his death, because we had been able to reduce this in a way I'll explain on my last slide, to something finite, which we couldn't prove. And a year later, Andrew Granville and Gerd Almquist proved it. But he showed that finite identity to Paul, who was looking quite sad and quite sick, who immediately rushed out of the room and came back 20 minutes later looking completely revived, saying, I have no idea how to prove it, but if you could prove it, it would have implication for Apérie's formula. So somehow, near the end of his life like that, he retrofitted everything we'd done, which is kind of cool. The second one was totally designed. It was proved by the computer using the Wilf-Zalberg algorithm that I suspect David will mention. If not, it was still proved that way. And then by a lot of people, including Wilf. And to finalize this story, two things. I would love to know if there's a similar generating function for Zeta 4k plus 1. And here's what we did. This is a famous picture of Riemann. It may be close to the one that Ram showed yesterday. You probably haven't seen this picture of Euler because it was after he was traded to the New York Yankees. So what did we do? Well, we used integer relation methods to as many as 5,000 digits to discover this generating function in a really entirely automated, if this is true, we will find this, then we will do that, then we will distill the compound and we'll pour this out. And we got, the second formula is basically definitional. This one is kind of amazing. Then at that stage, because of what we'd done 10 years earlier, I knew it should reduce to an equivalent universal finite identity. This is actually equivalent to this. David Bailey, Bradley I knew was very expert at these, so I asked him, can you take this and produce the appropriate universal finite combinatorial identity? This is something, of course, that you can type a million cases into Maple or Mathematica and check, but at the present time, in that form, it's almost impossible to prove directly. But I peered at it hard, and it becomes a much more beautiful, for those of you who know about hypergeometric functions, kind of canonical-looking identity, which says this hypergeometric function for each n is 2n choose n over 3n choose n. And this turns out to be in exactly the form that Wolff-Seilberger's telescoping algorithms can prove. You literally type this into Maple, have a certificate a minute later. And since then, we've actually got a number of human proofs. So the punchlines, I think, are that this sort of mathematics isn't particularly well captured by a canonical proof lemma corollary mechanism. Neither is a lot of stuff we've heard about described in the last day and a half, and we'll hear more about in the next few weeks, in the next few days. But as David, I think, will make clear, there's the prospects for doing what we started to call high-performance mathematics are pretty exciting, and I hope I've at least given you some things to think about. So thank you.